This is the Mike Garrigan Podcast.
Welcome to episode 16 of 24 in the Transitions Podcast series from MikeGarrigan.com. My name is Mike Garrigan. In 2001, at every Athenaeum show that year, there was a moment that I look forward to every night. During the song Radiance, there's this, grinding second verse guitar part. It's an F sus 2 chord that's chunked into a G sus 4 chord in eighth notes. It kind of sounds like this. So anyway, I played that part through a 50-watt Marshall British head, and I used a Y cable to access both channel 1 and channel 2 simultaneously. And on that song, playing a vintage SG by Gibson made sense. And during the verse, I'd often look over at Len, our guitar tech, and we'd nod as if to say, yeah, that sounds really good. At the time, market forces had been shifting guitar tones away from analog simplicity and toward a digital madness, and the authentic Marshall tone, it offered a shocking contrast to amp simulations and computer-driven tones. It was like a bull in a china shop of imposter china, if you can imagine that. And all of the parts I've played over the years, that part on Radiance is one of my favorites to have played. I didn't write it, of course, but just playing in the band and playing that part was one of my favorites. It was simple, and it had this exponential power to it. And I remember when I'd play that part, the stage would rattle under my feet, and it was rock and roll in its purest form. I play the guitar a lot. I play guitar so much that, this sounds strange, but I forget that it's a passion for me. I love all guitars, acoustics, electrics, hybrids, expensive ones, cheap ones, left-handed guitars, right-handed guitars especially, double necks, three-quarter sizes, ones with whammy bars, ones with classic bridges, ones with Bigsby's, ones with humbuckers, and ones with single coils, fretless guitars, whatever. Love them. Love them all. The first guitar that I played was my brother Joe's starter guitar. He had a $50 nylon string guitar. And it didn't sound very good, but I remember learning how to play a D chord on it by watching my dad play along with the Letterman LPs that were his favorites. My brother Joe played a little, but not a lot. And one afternoon, for some reason, we were all at a Fat Daddy's, and a fight broke out. And one of the GIs, the soldiers there, grabbed Joe's guitar out of his gig bag and hit another GI, another soldier, over the head with it. And the guitar was shattered into a dozen pieces. The outskirts of Fort Bragg could be rough sometimes, which was why we brought the guitar in from the car in the first place. My dad sympathized with us, and he allowed us to play his guitar, which was a more expensive nylon string, nicer guitar. And Joe played the guitar for a bit, but then he eventually took up to playing drums. But I, on the other hand, I played my dad's guitar through the end of 1987. And that Christmas, I got my first electric guitar, which was a Hohner Strat clone. Even from that early acoustic guitar and the electric guitar, those two things, the electric guitar and acoustic guitar, seemed like different things, different beasts. And the acoustic guitar was much more percussive and rhythmic, and the electric guitar sustained more and had a wider range. To alter the sound of the electric guitar, I used to chain together cables and pedals, and this excited the simple sounds I was able to squeeze out of my solid-state Gorilla amp. As a 12-year-old, I favored the electric guitar, although by 16 I would have switched back to the acoustic guitar when I began writing songs. In those first 4 years, I'd play in two cover bands, the KDF and Dead Center. I imagine if I had lived in Europe during the Middle Ages, I would have probably played lute or lyre, and I would have sung songs and attempted to perform the court of the king and queen, although based on my own track record in this lifetime, I would have probably been a regular among, I don't know, the retinue of a viscount or a duke. But what is known as the modern acoustic guitar, at least the kind that we use in rock and folk and country music, didn't appear on the scene until around the mid-1800s. The C.F. Martin Company was founded in Pennsylvania, partly in protest to an oppressive guild system in Europe, which forbid cabinet makers like the C.F. Martin Company from making guitars. And apparently, the Violin Guild was the only organization that could make musical instruments. Other than the fact that I thought an electric guitar was cooler than an acoustic one, the distinction between the two was lost on me until the summer of 1988. And that summer, my family, we all attended my cousin Jackie's wedding in Delaware. And the ceremony was a typical Catholic ceremony, but the reception was down the road at my Uncle Leland's farm. And the Money Farm, as it was called, his name is Leland Money, it went on for what seemed like miles, and there were two large party tents that marked the reception area, and in between Fast Eddie's disc jockeying and different bluegrass groups would take over one of the small stages in one of the tents, and every guitar there was a Martin, and it seemed like that brand, looking back on it now, it sounded good when you pushed it up against the scores of mandolins and fiddles that just seemed to appear out of nowhere. And the Martin tone was dark, and it was full of low mid-range and very pleasant to the ear. The reception was kind of strange because it seemed like more people were making music than listening to it, but it was a lot of fun. Later that summer, as I clued into the often-played acoustic guitars on MTV's Headbangers Ball, I noticed that heavy metal acoustic guitars were somewhat different. Sometimes these guitars with rounded backs had cables that came out of their the back of them, and they ran into what I thought was an amp of some kind. But actually, I'd find out later that in the early 90s that the acoustic guitar signal ran to what is called a direct input box. There is no amp. When I asked the clerk at McFadden Music what kind of guitar had a rounded back and a plug like that, he said, "Oh, that's the Ovation." He pointed overhead to where they kept the really expensive guitars, and then he pulled one down and handed it to me to try out. Now, the Ovation, it felt different from the Martin that I had checked out at Jackie's reception. Then I remember him saying, "You probably wouldn't record with it, but it sure does sound good live." And I don't know. I like the way Ovations sound, but they do sort of cut through a mix better than a Martin. On my regular guitar lesson Saturdays, I would visit the Ovation guitars and their underling counterparts, the Applause guitars. And like I said, these had a tinny sound compared with the rich, lush sound of the Martin. They did seem more metal, though, and I imagine that that would have sounded good and did sound good over a loud band. When I began writing my own songs, I revisited the acoustic guitar as a principal instrument. The acoustic seemed easier to sing over. I hijacked my father's nylon string guitar for a few years until my older brother gave me his Yamaha Eterna guitar, which I would go on to record the album Building a Hole with. And this guitar was more like one of those Martin guitars, but it had some obvious sonic deficiencies. It was the summer of 1995 when I drove down to Atlanta with John Gillespie and Nick Brown that I learned of this relatively new guitar that my friend Bob Bedell said was the best guitar he had ever played. Taylor guitars were gaining popularity. Bob played in an acoustic band called Catbird Seat, and John and I played an opening set for the Catbird Seat CD release party at Eddie's Attic in Decatur, Georgia. I couldn't help but notice how good not only Bob's Taylor sounded, but how good everyone's Taylor sounded. Everyone had one. When I purchased a Taylor later that summer, incidentally on the spoils of selling over 100 copies of Building a Hole at a single show, which even back then was an anomaly of sorts, I noticed first how bright the Taylor sounded. Compared to the Martin, it seemed to cut through the air better, and still, it wasn't piercing like the Ovation or like my Eterna. It was this happy medium. And later that fall, I began recording the album that would become The Lessons of Autumn, and I noticed a marked difference in the quality of even the work tapes, the rough mixes. Instead of having to stack a cheap guitar several times in the tracks to get a usable sound, like we did on Building a Hole, the Taylor was sufficient on its own to carry the complete track. By the time Collapsus was touring full bore, I purchased another Taylor, and this one had a sophisticated Fishman pickup system in the body of the guitar, and I noticed improvements even in the live sound of that guitar. And I guess the native sound, the sound that you just get out of it when you're sitting around, it was better too. And that Taylor supported the entire Promise of Summer album, and it would be my main acoustic guitar until September of 2002. One night after an Athenaeum show, I crashed at a house in a bad neighborhood because I didn't want to drive back to Chapel Hill, and well, I had my acoustic guitar stolen overnight. My bad. Probably shouldn't have parked there. But because I still had my first Taylor, I looked for a suitable live guitar replacement. I remember somewhere in passing liking this Guild Peregrine that the Fender Guitar Company, had sent to Athenaeum in 2001 while we were on the road. It was kind of strange. It just showed up. And Billy from Fender had sent the guitar to us one night. We were at the Handlebar in South Carolina. I tried it out, but honestly, I didn't care for the crimson color. It's like not my thing. A year later, after my live Taylor was stolen, I called Billy and I begged him to sell me a guitar maybe like the one he had sent out. And at the time, I had no instrument insurance. If you're listening and you're a musician, get instrument insurance. I would be paying out of pocket for this replacement. And it just so happened that the crimson guitar was this sort of, I don't know, unwanted guitar that just circulated around the country, and Billy was trying to get rid of it, so no one wanted it. And, you know, because it had been everywhere and back, it was looking for a home, and he offered to sell it to me at cost. And I bought it. I used this Guild Peregrine guitar for the remainder of my tenure with Athenaeum, as well as on the Live at the Evening Muse album that I put out in 2006. I gotta say, of all the acoustic guitars I've played in the live setting, not necessarily in the studio, the Guild Peregrine is the best. And rather than, you know, your traditional sound hole, it has these resonance chambers that, when it's paired with the Fishman bridge pickup, it offers this balanced, full, and loud tone that's just amazing. And so the two guitars I use nowadays are that original Taylor for studio recording. And if you've tuned into one of my stage it shows, you've seen this guitar and you've heard this guitar. And the Peregrine for live shows. I've played very expensive boutique guitars like specialty Taylors with Koa wood or you name it. Boutique models, handmade guitars, whatever. But these two guitars, the Taylor and the Guild, they meet my acoustic needs as both a touring musician and as a studio rat. Because every guitarist has a wish list, if I were to add to my acoustic collection, I would seek out a dark-sounding Martin guitar. It's a tone that I don't have, and I think it would be better suited to the kinds of recordings I'd like to make in the future. Sometimes I find my Taylor to be too bright, especially in that 3K range, but otherwise it's a great piece and I love it. My journey with electric guitars has been much more circuitous. I started with a decent Hohner Strat clone, and what that means, it's like a Fender, but it's a Hohner, so it's a clone. It's a Strat clone. I didn't know any better or any worse of an electric guitar. I got the guitar and I played it to the best of my ability. I like playing it through the dirty solid state channel of my Gorilla amp. I'd get home from school at 4 p.m. I'd play the guitar in the garage until dinner time, after which I'd do some homework or play more guitar. But one afternoon, I came home from school and our garage was broken into, and those thieves took my Hohner Strat clone guitar. Later that year, I think it was Christmas of 89, my parents got me an upgrade, a Charvel Fusion Custom. It was black with a hot-rodded stock humbucker pickup in the bridge and a Floyd Rose tremolo system. That meant I could do dive bomb harmonics. Learning with a whammy bar totally killed my upward bending vibrato, but otherwise I was developing into a relatively competent player. Not a year later, almost under identical circumstances, my Charvel was stolen, probably by the same kids, looking for stuff to pawn. I was playing so much that my parents sprung for an upgrade of the Charvel, and this was to a Jackson model, Fusion Custom, which was the Cadillac of guitars, or at least I thought so. All the metal players that I admired, they played a Jackson guitar. Randy Rhoads had a Flying V Jackson. Dave Mustaine from Megadeth played a Jackson, and I'm almost certain that Phil Collin from Def Leppard also played a Jackson during the Hysteria years. And when I got this guitar, I felt like I had arrived. I played that guitar until my senior year of high school, during which I switched to playing acoustic more, but it was just because of a songwriting factor thing. I played this Jackson Fusion Custom through a Princeton Chorus amp, and these solid-state amps, they were great, unless you had played a real tube amp. It did the job for a while. I loved this amp. And when I lived in the dorm at the University of North Carolina, guitar amplifiers were a housing violation or something to that effect. You weren't allowed to play electric guitar through an amplifier. The acoustic guitar, no problem. Electric guitar, amplified, not good. So when I would play the electric guitar in my room, I had to have the window shades drawn and the windows closed and the door locked, lest I get written up for rocking out. Now, the rule seemed a bit inconsistent because the guys across the hall, they would play Jodeci and Boys to Men loud enough to where I didn't even need a stereo in my room. It was so loud, it would rattle the whole place. But for some reason, electric guitars, no good. One day, I was playing along to the new Nirvana album, and I was playing along to Milk It, that song Milk It from what's it called? In utero, yeah. And I heard a loud knock on my door, and I opened the door, and it was the RA, and I was busted. He said, "Mike, you know, electric guitars aren't allowed in the dorms." And I expected him to, you know, pull out a white slip and write me up, and I was going to get, you know, sent home or something. But instead, this was really strange. He asked if he could play my guitar, and he strummed it for a little while and did some licks and, you know, got some good grind out of it. Then he gave it back to me, and he didn't say a word, and that was weird. I moved on to an apartment not long after that. The beginnings of the band that became Collapsis proved to present a problem. On songs like October, I would play an acoustic guitar, but on the new songs like Automatic and Superhero, the Princeton chorus slash Jackson guitar setup wasn't going to cut it. It wasn't loud enough, and it just was deficient. So I bought a $500 Epiphone Les Paul from Musician's Friend, and I borrowed my friend Kyle's Fender Hot Rod Deluxe. I borrowed it for a year until we were signed and had an instrument budget. But the Epiphone played well. It played great. And that guitar I had stolen by, I don't know, this guy who just borrowed it, never returned it. I don't know what happened to him. I've tried to reach out to him a couple times, friend him on social media, but never hear back from him. So you can go ahead and keep it if you're listening to this. But my first foray into real electric guitars, and I'm talking like the real deal, the vintage guitars, it was a bit of an accident. Collapsis had just, you know, signed a deal, and we had a decent gear budget, and everyone could up their gear to a professional level. This was a really great part of being on a label at the time. So, you know, the word was out that I was looking for gear for an amp and a guitar that would be good enough to carry a professional band in the late 90s. And there was a tech from the Music Loft in Durham. He called me one afternoon and said, "The Eagle has landed. You need to get down here immediately." And I knew that he had been looking out for a guitar for me, but what I found when I arrived was the mother lode. Somebody had brought in a vintage 1967 SG into the store for sale, and the tech told me that for some reason they could only mark it up so much, and that the owner wouldn't take more than a little for it. So I had bought an authentic vintage Gibson SG for a fourth of its Blue Book value. And the SG, the solid guitar, came out in the 1960s when Gibson and Les Paul had a bit of a rift between their products. And Gibson stopped running the Les Paul, and they ran the solid guitar line. This was through the 60s. And then the Les Paul would reappear in the 70s. The guitar that I had stumbled upon was made in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It played like a dream, and compared to the Epiphone, it resonated more, it sustained more, and it had better pickups, it interacted with the air better, and it remains my favorite electric guitar in my collection, and it even has a prize spot on the wall at Two Egrets. If you've ever been to the studio, you know that directly to the right of the light switch is the SG. As Collapsis gained momentum, I required a second guitar. Now, that sounds kind of strange. I required a guitar, but if you've ever had to do guitar changes or needed a sufficient backup, you understand why a second guitar is necessary. And the Les Paul I had was fair, but it didn't compare to the robust vintage tone of the SG. And Ryan, the guitar player in Collapsis, he offered to sell me his 1981 Les Paul Deluxe at a great price in exchange for squatter's rights if I should ever sell it. And this guitar was loud, and it was full and noisy in all the right ways. So I'd use it on the drop D songs and on a few of the rockers. But for the novice players and lay people out there, drop D is a tuning where One drops the low-pitched E string to D, and playing the bottom three strings with the same fretting creates a super power chord. And I never understood when students of mine or even the masses of guitar players refer to the lowest pitch string as the high string. This is inconsistent and totally confusing, and I heretofore will always refer to the low-pitched E string as the low E. When I joined Athenaeum a few years later, the variance in guitar tunings required two more electric guitars. I played an SG on most of the Radiant songs, but the second album songs were in all kinds of crazy tunings. Frozen in Time and Sweeter Love, for example, were in the tuning D-A-D-A-A-E. Plurabelle and On Her Way, a B-side that would later be released on Hourglass, were in the same tuning as Frozen, but they were a half step down. And when I joined Athenaeum, the band had a Fender endorsement, and I was a new member, so they were able to swing a 40% of cost deal for me, which was really nice. So I picked up a 52, it was a 51 reissue, I'm not sure, a early 50s Telecaster reissue, and a early 60s Stratocaster reissue, as well as a Guild 12-string acoustic. And I should mention that, unfortunately, the 12-string was also stolen on that unfortunate night of poor decision-making.
Silhouettes and cigarettes and road lines, I feel the way the road winds, driving for a long time. I just wanna see you tonight. If I can, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna see you tonight. I'm gonna see you tonight. And it's gonna make everything alright. I'm gonna see you tonight. Infinity is far between the stars.
Gonna make everything alright.
good friend of mine gifted me a Gretsch hollow body guitar around 2010, and this has been the last electric guitar that I've acquired, and it's certainly more than I need. But because every guitar player has a wish list, if I could add two pieces to my guitar collection, I know exactly what I would seek. First, a 1959 Les Paul is the holy grail of guitars. Something about the sunburst finish, the hand-wired electronics, and its weight make it a classic. If you've ever heard Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction, just about everybody has, it's what Slash played on most of the songs. I believe I either rented a 59 Les Paul or I borrowed something like it to play most of the electric parts on Dirty Wake. I'm almost certain I played some sort of 59-ish Les Paul on the solo to Automatic. If it wasn't a 59, it was a lot like one. Steve Vai's Passion and Warfare is an important album to me. It's one of the best all-instrumental metal records in history, perhaps tied with Satriani's Surfing with the Alien. On Passion and Warfare, Steve Vai introduced the Ibanez Universe guitar, a hot-rodded shredder with a whammy bar and a low B string. When on the third song, called The Animal, the guitars go down to an incomprehensibly low tone. It doesn't make sense. And it was groundbreaking. I'd never heard that. What was he doing? Is he using a whammy bar? Is he just detuned? No, he had an extra string on the bottom of the guitar. And a few years later, the band Korn began using these Universe guitars, but they tuned the B down to an earth-rumbling A. And if you recall from my explanation what a drop D tuning is, these created these very low super power chords. And by doing so, they created the genre nu metal. And the Universe guitar is still available through the Ibanez company. And for me, if I had one, it would meet my metal guitar desires while also offering some utility with its low B string. I still have my Jackson Fusion, which is a decent traditional metal guitar. If I got used to the Universe guitar, I would probably opt to get a Gem 7, the Universe's six-string counterpart. And this guitar has a monkey grip handle carved into the body just in case you ever want to get extra flamboyant on stage. It's there. Amplification has always been a relatively straightforward issue for me. Ryan and I had drove up to Roanoke, Virginia one Saturday in 1998, and we found a Marshall 50-watt British head and a 412 matching cabinet with a nice salt and pepper grill cloth. And what we realized on the way home is that this is basically the same amp or the type of amp that Angus Young used in the early days. And these amps were designed to be played in arenas. So it's necessary to find a way to reduce the output somehow. I bought this thing called a power break to get the full tone out of the amp. And the power break is sort of a negative volume switch, if that makes sense. And the way tube amps work is that the louder the signal sent to the tube, the more the signal breaks up and distorts. To get a nice, full, classic distorted tone, you only need to drive your tube amp to the point where it produces the tone you want. It gets a little crunchy. And then the power break will reduce the overall master output. During the weekdays on the road, Collapsus would often do these in-between pickup gigs in really small clubs and coffee shops and the like, and we couldn't fit these Marshall amps into these little stages. And one time we played a pizza joint. It's like, well, what are we doing? But that after that show, we decided that we were going to create a what's called a B-rig scenario. And when we would get to a club, we would go in, observe, and say, is it an A-rig or a B-rig? The B-rig was the small amps, and the A-rig was the big amps. But Ryan and I, we bought these matching Pro Junior 15-watt tube amps. And these were, ironically, louder than the Marshalls because they had an open back configuration. And the closed back Marshall cabinets tended to focus the sound and point it, but the open back amps went everywhere. And to this day, these are the only two amps that I've ever needed in a live setting. And I got to say, I do prefer the tube amps to the modeling amps that are coming out and also the boutique amps, which are quite nice. Over the years, my friend Mark from Athenaeum, he's had some of the nicest matchless DC-30 amps I've ever heard. But, you know, when I play a DC-30, I just couldn't get it to sound as good as the Marshall, the Pro Junior. And I think it's just a function of the way I play. Those are the amps that I sound good with. Now, in the studio, I do prefer emulation and modeling amps better than tube amps. I know this sounds like a contradiction, but it's not, because the studio is a microscope. Every deficiency in the wiring of an amp or a microphonic tube or rattling tube, that's audible. And the cost of recording with a properly biased amp is cost prohibitive. And the modeling software, say from Avid's 11 or Contax Guitar Rig 5 or any of the Line 6 products, are outstanding for studio applications. I've had a love-hate relationship with pedals over the years. When Ryan joined Collapsus, he pulled me aside after the first few gigs, after I was doing a tap dance show with my pedals. He said, look, man, if you want me to play in this band, you're going to have to learn how to play with effects. And the best way to learn to play with effects is to not use them, to only use a tuner for a while. And from that point on, he taught me how to get a superior rock tone with just a tube amp and just the volume knob on the electric guitar. And this lesson also taught me the principles of onstage dynamics. If I set my tube amp to around the 7 mark, when I wanted to play clean, I would simply put my volume knob on my guitar at 3. And if I played a dirty rhythm, I would put my guitar on 7. If I played a lead, I turned it up to 10. After we recorded Dirty Wake, I ended up adding an analog delay pedal and a Vox wah-wah pedal to a very small pedal board that it also had a trigger board for samples. So even today, with the Collapsus reunions, I keep the effects to a minimum, often only using a tuner. Athenaeum presented a different scenario. There, I was stepping into a role where the parts and the guitar player who played them relied heavily on effects, and some songs had specific delays set to a specific tempo. Other songs had a phaser sound to them that didn't quite sound right unless you had the phaser sound on. Still others required a Leslie rotation effect. And to meet these needs, I purchased 3 of the Line 6 modeling effects pedals and a Hughes and Kettner rotosphere. I also purchased an elaborate pedal board to house all the effects, and these 16 tones, separate tones, did the job. Although, for distortion, I usually still relied on the amp tone. There were a couple scenarios in which distortion was a little over the top and needed to be. The one drawback to relying on amp tone is that clubs have gotten smaller within the past 15 years. an original band with a decent regional or even local following used to have no problem filling a 300 to 600 person capacity club. Now, I see bands with adequate fans struggling to fill even a 100 person club. Cover bands are a different story, but as for the true original artist, less people are supporting that endeavor nowadays. Being so, the clubs that original artists find themselves playing in have shrunk in size. They're smaller. And because they have shrunk, even a 15-watt tube amp may be too loud for the sound guy to handle. This is why we've seen the proliferation of 8-watt and even 5-watt micro tube amps in recent years. These are also great practice pieces, but man, what I wouldn't have given for a 5-watt amp at that first Collapsus reunion show in 2013. I did not get the tone I wanted because my amp was just too darn loud. Now, if I were making a pedal board from scratch, the most elaborate effect I would have on there would be a programmable delay pedal. I'd also include an authentic MXR Phase 90, and I'd have a distortion pedal, maybe just one. But the focus on that pedal, the distortion, would be just to boost the signal. Maybe a tube screamer set to a gentle grit and boost would work. And the tuner would be the essential first element and focus of the pedal board. In terms of progression as a player, when people ask me, how long does it take to get good? How long will it take me to play a gig? And I've found that since I have been playing guitar from the age of 11 until now, that my progression as a player has arrived in plateaus. When I was first starting out, I'd stay at a general level of proficiency for a few months, and then presto, I'd have a breakthrough. And with that breakthrough, I found that I could play something that had previously given me difficulty, and I could play it now with greater ease. I think the best way to get good at anything is to spend focused time doing that thing. Malcolm Gladwell speaks of this 10,000 hours theory that another psychologist purported in order to become proficient at something. That makes sense. And the 10,000 hours doesn't guarantee excellence, but it does offer a likely time frame in which one can master a concept or skill. In his book Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence, Daniel Goleman points out that the 10,000 hours theory is necessary for mastery, but it is not sufficient for mastery. This means that spending 10,000 hours practicing guitar doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be any good. What motivated me in the beginning was a passion for music. I liked listening to music. I liked watching metal shows on TV. I would first find a song that I really wanted to learn how to play. Then I would seek out tablature for that song and practice it until I could play it. And tablature is a hybridization of written notes and guitar fretting. So when you hear a guitar player talk about tabs, this is what they're talking about. This goes without saying, but playing in the beginning is not pretty. I was sloppy, noisy, non-rhythmic for years. I made more mistakes than successes, but for me, playing the guitar was fun. I found enjoyment in it. I didn't care that I was awful at it for many years. But once I had a basic understanding of chords and I could play for a little bit, what I did was, well, I joined my church's folk band. And we'd play for masses on Saturday at 5:30 p.m. It was the folk mass. And we had rehearsals on Wednesdays for a few hours. And playing in this group helped me learn the concept of group dynamics, and it also exposed me to basically any chord I would ever come across in my life. I should mention that an hour of playing in front of a crowd is worth more than 10 hours of private rehearsal time behind closed doors. And in tandem with playing in this folk band, I also started a band in the seventh grade with my friends Peter, Steven, and Ricky. And Frank joined in too later. We weren't very good, but we played for our friends every chance we got. I reached a plateau with my speed and agility around 1991. Just a few months ago, I attempted to learn note for note Randy Rhoads' solo and all the parts to the song Over the Mountain from Diary of a Madman. And while my brain knows what to play, my fingers just can't move fast enough to play the song at record tempo. It is frustrating. And this is why some players are amazing prodigies, and some of us just aren't. There is a humbling limit to how fast or how good someone can get on the guitar. I think pushing yourself is the only way to find out what that limit is. Playing in major label bands and non-major label bands, just bands in general, but the major label bands where the spotlight is on you and it has to be right. That is what helped my stagecraft. It has helped my band dynamics, the sense of how you play with a band, sense of improvisation and my timing. And stepping into Athenaeum after having played in Collapsus was almost an outright shock. It was like a different world. And I would rehearse for 8 hours a day for a month just to get those parts down. And I was terrified I wouldn't be able to do it, but eventually I locked in, you know. And what I listen for whenever I'm playing in a band is I listen for the kick drum to find out where the root is, and I also listen to the hi-hat that the drummer's playing. And as long as I'm locked into those things, I don't draw attention away from the rhythm, and I'm in sync. In 2005, I should mention that I began this strange 18-month foray into playing jazz. If you want to talk about limits, this was, in my estimation, the most difficult genre to play in. It required a mastery of both the instrument itself, as well as a full vocabulary of scales, modes, and licks that would allow a competent, on-the-spot composition that happens totally in the moment. I think one jazz musician referred to it as creating a masterpiece by midnight. Playing Herbie Hancock's Maiden Voyage, for example, requires improvising in a shifting Mixolydian mode, if you know what that is. It's the fifth, seventh type mode. The art is knowing how to step out of those boxes and transition into others while still keeping the form that the band is supplying behind you. It's very difficult. And I enjoyed that foray. It was a lot of fun. But, you know, if you ever see me nowadays and I'm staring off into space, chances are I'm playing guitar in my mind.